May I invite you to the greatest desire of a Christian, Philippians 3, verse 10. The greatest desire of a Christian, Philippians 3, verse 10. I hear pages ruffling. If you've gotten to Colossians, you've gone too far. If you're stuck at Ephesians, you haven't gone far enough. It is in Philippians chapter 3, verse 10, that we read the greatest desire of a Christian. It is found in that first line, that I may know him. Every other desire pales in insignificance to this one, that I may know him. When you look in Scripture, the great men and women of God had this as their passion, that I may know him. Moses said, Lord, show me your glory. David said, as the deer pants after the water brook, so pants my soul after thee, O God. Paul says that I may know him. Fix it any way you want. The bottom line is still the same. The greatest desire of a Christian is to know him. Did you know it's possible to be a Christian and not know him? It's possible to be on your way to heaven and not know him. You say, does the Bible really teach that? Think back with me. You don't have to turn there, but in John 14, verse 9, Philip asked Jesus, having followed him for a number of years, when are we going to see the Father? And Jesus' response was, have you been with me this long and still don't know me? He'd hung around, he'd heard the word, he'd seen the miracles, but he did not know him. Perhaps our problem is in the definition of the word know. You see, when the Bible talks about knowing him, it is not purely an intellectual exercise. It is not knowing facts about him. When a baby is born into a family, it's really born. It really has life, but at the point of birth, it does not know its parent. Over time, a bond occurs so that they know mommy and know daddy. In other words, maturity sets in, and the greater the maturity, the greater the knowledge. Immature Christians don't know him. They may know about him. They may be able to quote verses. They may be able to tell you what church they belong to, but to know him. Well, that's a different story. When employers are wanting employees to fulfill various positions, it usually starts off with a resume. And when they pull out the resume, they can read about the potential candidate. God has a great resume. In fact, if you ask God for his resume, he's got 66 books that you have to thumb through to get all. And then after you've read the 66 books, you've only just been introduced to him. He's got a good resume, but you can know the resume and not know God. When an applicant wants a job, you go from resume to reference. You pick up and you ask, tell me about so-and-so, because you want somebody to validate that what's on the paper is real. You don't just want to read the paper, you want a testimony. You want somebody who has been with that person for some time who can testify that everything that's written, because see, when folk write resumes, you know what I'm talking about. You don't put everything on them resume. You don't put that job you were fired from. You don't put that job you quit before you got fired from it. You don't put the bad relationships. And when they say references, you only put folk on talk good about you. You want references. The only problem with references, when it comes to knowing somebody is references only tell you what they know. They only give you their experience. That's why when you move from resume to reference, there's got to be a personal interview. You want to see them for yourself. You want to see how they sit and talk and communicate. You want to see whether this guy coming in for this professional job is walking in with braids in his hair. You want to see whether he bathed and took some certs before he dare come and talk to you. You want to see if there's the ability to pull off the job description. To put it another way, you want to get an impression. You want to feel them. You just want to see them. Some people get hired not because they had the best resume, but the employer felt a little better after a personal interview. To know God is not merely to have a biblical resume on him, nor is it to hear the testimony from somebody else. It's to have had your own personal interview and decided he is who he said he was. I like the way the old folk put it. You don't know like I know. What they were telling you is that they had an interview. and he is everything that they declared him to be. So knowing Christ involves information. You need the resume. But it also involves the goal of the information. It's like a map. You read a map, that's good, but you also have to take the journey. You also have to begin the process of getting there. Paul writes, and he has quite a resume here. He spends the first six verses, giving his vita, his performa, his resume. He tells you when it came to Jewish leaders, he was the apex. If performance gave you the knowledge of God, he ought to have had it because his resume was so spectacular. But he says in order to know him, he had to put his resume aside. He could not come and know him coming to God bragging about how great he was, not to know him. I remember a class I took in seminary, and we were to write a paper that needed to be dialogued on, and I felt real confident about this paper. And so I took this as an opportunity to wax eloquent about my biblical knowledge, academic understanding, and exegetical skills. And so I sat down, pen in hand, yellow pad in hand, and I waxed eloquent. I would tell you what it's about, but it's too embarrassing. But I waxed eloquent page after page. I think they wanted a 10-page report. I turned in a 25-page report because I wanted to let my professor know what I knew. I got the paper back after a couple of weeks with a grade on it. Zero. I was a little bit evangelically ticked off. How you gonna give me a zero? I work like a dog to give you this great assignment. Then he had written under the zero, great paper, wrong assignment. I had worked up a sweat answering the wrong question. I answered what he didn't ask because I didn't know him. I didn't understand where he was coming from. And so I put his thinking in my image and came up with a wasted report. See, when you take God and reduce him to you, your paper's not going to come out right. Oh, by the way, and neither is your life. When you take God and reduce him to you, then you wind up answering questions he's not asking. That's why Paul says we have no confidence in the flesh, verse 3. We don't look to a human approach to proceed with this knowledge of God. He says that I might know him. That was his passion. And in order to know him, he says in verse 7, whatever things were gained to me, all of my human accomplishments, those things I counted as loss for the sake of Christ. He had to be willing to turn his back on his human accomplishments in order to gain the knowledge of Christ. Did you hear that? He had to say no to who he was. Now, that goes against our normal humanity. We want to be credited for who we are, complimented for who we are, acknowledged for who we are. And that's great on the human level, but when you stand before God, you are but dust, and so am I. So he says, I want to know him. More than that, verse 8, I count all things to be lost. Please note in verse 7, the word count has an ED on it. In verse 8, the word count does not. Because in verse 7, he's talking about when he got saved. He got saved by trusting the righteousness of Christ alone. In verse 8, he's talking about how he's being sanctified. He's being sanctified by doing the same thing that he did when he got saved, which was continue to count all things as lost. So it's in the present tense. In other words, what he started at the cross, he has continued doing now in his converted state. He didn't do what many Christians do, get saved by grace and think they can be sanctified by flesh. Our own human attempts. So his priority is knowing Christ. And he will let nothing in the world get in the way of knowing Christ. So the first question from this passage about your greatest desire is this your greatest passion? Is knowing Christ your priority? Is there anything in your life and my life more critical than knowing Christ for myself? You can't live your life off of other folks' testimony. God's got to give you your own. He now goes from the priority of knowing Christ to the power of knowing Christ. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection. Let me read that one more time. That I may know him. And when I know him, I will know it because of the new power that I have and the power that got him up out of the grave. Every believer in Jesus Christ has been resurrected, for we died with him, were buried with him, and have risen with him. But every believer in Jesus Christ who has been raised with Christ doesn't necessarily know the power of the resurrection. There's a difference. Many know the fact of the resurrection, but they don't know the power of the resurrection because they've never experienced it. Or they experienced it so long ago, they forgot what it feels like. He says, I want to know the power of the resurrection. What does he mean? He means I want to know what it looks like to live a resurrected life. I want to know what it looks like to no longer be in bondage to the flesh. I want to know what it looks like to have victory over sin. This is all that Romans chapter 6 talks about. I want to know him so much that the same power that got him up out of that tomb gets me up out of my sin, gets me up out of my situations so that I live above the circumstances rather than always living under the circumstances. I want to know him. He says the way you know him is that you live a resurrected life too. If you take a fireplace poker and the fireplace is on and you leave it in there long enough, the tip of that poker is going to be bright red, signifying that the heat from the fireplace has rubbed off on the poker. If you would then with that poker touch a piece of paper, that paper would catch fire. The paper would catch fire because the fire from the fire has invaded the poker. So whatever the fireplace poker touches will be lit aflame too. If you've been hanging around with Christ long enough, and you know it. His resurrection rubs off on you so that what you touch catches his fire. He says, I want to have this resurrected kind of life. Please notice, Paul does not spend time wanting to know sin. He spends time wanting to know him. Paul understands that the way you get victory is not through a sin focus. That's like asking a rattlesnake to have a poison focus. It's a misplaced directive. His focus is on knowing Christ, because he knows if he knows Christ, the power of the resurrection will override the power of sin in the flesh. Many people walk their dogs with leashes. Usually one goes in one of two ways, dog dragging them, them dragging the dog. But when a dog and its master have a real tight relationship, don't need a leash, because he's going to stick by the master's side, because there's an invisible leash called relationship. And that relationship keeps him close. The closer you are to your dog, the less restraint you have to put on them and pull on them and tug on them. They just stay close because they don't want distance. He says, I want to know the power of just being close. I want to know the power of relationship. I want to know the power of this intimacy. I want that to be my experience, not just somebody else's testimony. So, this must be your passionate cry, that I may know him. And what you want to know about him is power. Well, I have to go further. I'm sorry for this. But in order to know power, you have to have fellowship with his suffering. So you start with priority. I want to know him. And that means you'll experience power as long as you're willing to fellowship with his pain. He says, I want the fellowship of his suffering. Now, everybody wants the good stuff. And I understand that. I want the good stuff too. I don't go pain hunting, and neither should you. But you have to understand, you can't hang out with Jesus Christ and know him and only have good things happen. Any theology that tells you that is wrong. The closer you get to Christ, the greater enemy you become of Satan. In case you didn't know that, Satan is not into Christ. Neither is the world, the flesh. Why did Christ suffer when he was on earth? What was it? Why did negative things come into his experience? Because he was pure, holy, clean. And so he would always have enemies. Satan would attack him. Because you had a clean person living in a sinful world. That's why he had pain. If you're a sinful person living in a sinful world, you blend in. If you're a righteous person living in a sinful world, that's fodder for the cross. For he who knew no sin became sin for us. As you go down the road of knowing him, you're going to run into challenges that are tough, awkward, and painful. And it is at that point that the decision you face comes alive. Do you want to know him? Why? Because at the place of suffering, there is always simultaneously to it the call to intimacy. When you face a trial, not caused by sin, That needs to be confessed and repented of. But I'm talking about a trial, and you're trying to live right. You're trying to please the Lord. You're not out there trying to rebel, and you run, bam, into a brick wall. God is now answering your prayer. Are you listening? No question do I get more problematic than this one. No question do I ask that's more problematic than this one, and that is, why is this happening to me? Isn't that the most painful question? To have that question and no answer. I cannot give you the details of why a certain scenario is happening to you. You cannot give me the details about why a certain situation is happening to me. But I can give all of us a detail on this. If our desire is to know him, one of the main reasons God allows the trial is he's ready to go to the next intimacy level. When people refurnish antique furniture, they have to take sandpaper and strip it. But they're not into messing up furniture. They're into increasing value. If your shirt is wrinkled, you heat up the iron, you put it on the ironing board, and you begin to lay steam on it, or the blouse, or the dress, or whatever it is, and that shirt gets hot. It is ablaze, not only with heat, but with weight. Isn't that how trials feel? Hot and heavy. They make your heart get heavy. They make your mind get heavy. And you feel like you are aflame. Now, I don't know much about ironing. I've never ironed anything in my natural life. God gave me a mama and a wife. That took care of both of those. Moving right along. But I know this. Ironing is for one purpose and one purpose alone. To make something look good when you put it on. It's got all wrinkles in it when you lay it down. But you put the weight of the pressure and the steam of the heat, and that which would not have been presentable is now very presentable. You see, God wants to put you on. He wants to wear you, and when he puts you on, he wants to be proud of how good you look. But that means he's got to iron out some wrinkles. And that can get hot and heavy. Now, the temptation when you are being conformed to his suffering is to run from it. Is to say, I don't want this. Because we don't. We don't. I don't. I don't want the pain, the struggle, the heaviness of the trial. Especially when you don't know how long God has you on the ironing board. Especially when he's not giving you timetables. My wife is now a seminarian. She now goes to Dallas Seminary, and she's taking a course on the kingdom with Dr. Pentecost. Now, she decided she's going to audit the class. Because when you audit, you don't have to do any of the work. You go, sit, listen, leave. Okay? So like some of you do on Sunday and Wednesday night. Go. I'm sorry. That's, you know I love you. I love you. But she'd been rethinking that, and she's thinking about taking it for credit. Only one problem. There are these three big books, huge, 400 pages. It's three of them. So she's got to read. So she's thinking about this. Auditing is easy. No pain in auditing. You go, sit, listen, leave. But to get credit, costs. She said, "Do you have these books? Let me see these books." I went and got the books. I had a few of them. She saw these books like that. Whoa! I am not sure if I'm going to audit or take that for credit. Why? Because that means you have to do stuff when you're not in class. Like doing stuff when you're not in church. We're going to work this thing. Stick with me here. All right, have you decided whether you're going to audit or not or take it for credit? She's sitting up in the balcony. I'm in trouble. Well, have you decided? You're not going to take it for granted? She's a lot like a lot of y'all. Oh, anybody have an extra bedroom here? Some people try to audit their way through life. Let me explain. You don't get credit until you take it for credit. Until you say, "Lord, what do you want me to learn from this that I might know you?" But how long? I don't know. And yes, we want to run. I'm not talking about creating problems, causing problems. I'm talking about when God puts you in the fire and you have no choice. When he wants to strip us of our self-sufficiency, when he wants to let us know we cannot do it on our own, without him, we can do nothing. If you are going through a trial today, I don't know all the sub-purposes of the trial. I do know this one. It's a call to intimacy. Are you going to audit? Or are you going to take it for credit so you can move on? Don't be like the teenager who called the dentist, but he scared to death of dentist because he had teeth problems. He called, the secretary answered, "May I make an appointment with the dentist?" She said, "The dentist is out of town. Would you please call back another time?" He said, "Okay. When will he be out of town again?" You still have your toothache or your life ache or whatever. So serious was he about this that he says in verse 10, "I want to be conformed to his death." That is the kind of death he had. A righteous man suffering for an unrighteous reason. Why? Verse 11. "In order that I may attain to the resurrection of the dead." It's an interesting Greek word because it's a unique Greek word. The phrase resurrection is out of resurrection. It literally means I want to be the out of dead one. Out of dead one. What does he mean by out of dead one or resurrected one? But this particular word talks about the resurrection out of. What does he mean? He means that I want to stand out among the crowd. In the midst of spiritual death, I want to be a picture of life. In the midst of folk defeated, I want to be a picture of victory. In the midst of folk who want to throw in the towel, I want to be one who stands above the crowd. I do not want to be a depressed single. But in the midst of all the other singles who are going around whining and crying and bemoaning the fact that I'm not married yet, I want to be the out of resurrected one. I want to be the one the other singles come to and say, well, I'm like you in my situation, but I'm not like you in my joy. I want to be out among, I want to be above the crowd. When I go to work, I don't just want to be whining and complaining with everybody else. I want them to see that I have life. I'm resurrected. But I don't want it to be because I have to do it because I'm supposed to do it or do this fake Christian stuff. I want to do it because I know it. So that's the way it really is. I know it. So he starts off with a priority that I might know him. He says that with that priority comes power, a resurrected life. With that power comes pain. So how do I make it? By gaining a new perspective, the perspective of knowing Christ. Please notice what he says, verse 14. Well, let me read verse 13 first. Brethren, I do not regarding myself as having laid hold of it yet. And now that's good news. I'm sure glad Paul told me this. Because if he's not there yet, I'm all right. He says, I still have a ways to go, folks. I'm not there yet. I'm not there yet. Forgetting those things which lie behind, I can't fix yesterday. I should have done better yesterday. I didn't. But if I spend all my time on yesterday, I'm going to be miserable today, which means I'm going to mess up tomorrow. Because tomorrow will become today. By the way, did you know tomorrow doesn't exist? Because when you get to tomorrow, it's today. You know? Take all the time you need with that one. I know that was deep. Just he gains a perspective that all of the believers don't have. Notice what he says in verse 17. Brethren, join in following my example. Observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. For many walk, of whom I often told you and now tell you even weeping, that they are enemies of the cross. Everybody walking is not walking with you. Whose end is destruction, whose God is their appetite, whose glory is their shame, who have set their mind on earthly things. What is going to keep you going? Well, he tells you in verse 20, our citizenship is in heaven. He says you have to have a new perspective. Now, this is one of those statements in Scripture that you have to flip-flop in order to appreciate. The way you live victoriously on earth is by developing the mindset of heaven. He says, the ones who are defeated, whose God is their appetite, referring to the fact they live on the physical level only. He says, the reason that they do that is their mind is always on earthly things. He says, but your citizenship is in heaven. That's your true country. Now, don't misunderstand what he's saying. He is not suggesting to be heavenly minded so you're no earthly good. He's not suggesting that you walk around with your head up in the clouds. He is saying the way you make it down here is by having the mindset of up there. Went on vacation for a month. Away from home. Away from my national home, America. Away from my local home, Dallas. Away from my ministry home, Oak Cliff. Praise God for telephones. As Hawkins has already told you. I pick up the phone and like E.T., call home. Because when I was in Switzerland, that wasn't my home. It was beautiful. It was nice. It was enjoyable. It was lovely. Lovely. It was wonderful. Beautiful. Way out there, way out there, okay. Marvelous. Extraordinary. But it wasn't home. When I was in Austria, fantabulous. But it wasn't home. It wasn't home. No place like home. After 30 days, it was time to come home. I never made any of those places my home. Now, didn't mean I couldn't enjoy being there. Couldn't mean I couldn't enjoy the sights and the sounds of places I'd only seen in pictures and to have a great, restful time. God is not saying to think heavenly is not to enjoy earth or benefit from earth or tour the facilities. He's saying it's not home. And if you ever treat it like it's home, then you will miss out on heaven here. He is saying that when we adopt a mindset that loses the perspective of eternity, we've messed up our victory in time. The one place that we loved most was Florence, Italy. Magnificent city. The place we loathed most was Pisa, Italy. Now you know Pisa. The Leaning Tower is in Pisa. Leaning Tower. We got on a train, rode for an hour to see the Leaning Tower. The biggest waste of time of the trip. Okay? Nothing like it looks on television. It's not that high, and it's the only thing in town. Really. There's no other reason to go to Pisa than to see a building do that. That's it. That's the only reason you go there, all right? You know, they've been spending a lot of time and money trying to get this building straight. This building, you know, because it keeps leaning further, so they got cables holding it up now. If you want the Leaning Tower to look straight, that'll never happen. You have to bend. See, if you want to be on line with the tower, you have to bend because the tower is going to stay crooked. This world's going to stay crooked. Okay? So what we got is a lot of Christians bending with it. I'm not talking about enjoying it, benefiting from it. I'm talking about making it home. It's like the yuppie or buppy, depending on your particular cultural nuance, who was driving his brand new Jaguar. And he had an accident. I mean, a terrible accident. He was thrown from the car, and the car went over the precipice. Police drove up, but the man was laying out there, half dying. My Jaguar. My Jaguar. Police Barkley said, your Jaguar. Said, man, you laying here and your arm has been detached from your body. He didn't know that he had lost his arm. No arm. He finally looks over. Blood is pouring out of where his arm used to be. When he sees that, he says, my Rolex, my Rolex. All right. Confused perspective. You get my point. Enjoy your vacation on earth, but don't call it home. Enjoy your 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. God blesses you immensely, 100 years. Enjoy your vacation on earth. It's not home. And as long as you remember it's not home and treat it like it's not home, you can live here victoriously. When you make it home, you've made it something it was never intended to be. Some of you will recognize the name Florence Chadwick. In 1952, Florence Chadwick was the first woman to attempt to swim the 26 miles between Catalina Island and the California coastline. She had already swum the English Channel. She got in the water in 1952 and began her 26-mile freestyle journey. Of course, whenever they do that, they have these side boats that will watch out for them, that watch out for sharks, as she began to cross the waterway. Hour after hour, Florence was in the water freestyling and swimming. But after about 15 hours, when darkness had set in and a deep, thick fog, she said to the boats that were nearby, and her mother was in one boat, Mom, I don't think I can make it. Her mother said, go, girl, you can make it, you can make it. She said, I'll try, and she swam for another 55 minutes. 15 hours and 55 minutes, and then she quit. Got up in the boat. She didn't make the distance. Only to discover that when she got up in the boat, she was one half a mile from the California shoreline. When asked why she quit, she said, because I couldn't see the shoreline. There was too much fog, and I could not see my goal. And because I didn't see my goal, because I couldn't see how much further I had, it wasn't that I was that tired, it's that I just lost hope. Two months later, girlfriend got back in the water. But this time it was different. She swam from Catalina Island to the shores of California successfully, straight 26 miles. And when asked how she did it, same situation, same dark night, and same fog. She said, this time when I swam, I kept a picture of the shoreline in my head. I couldn't see it with my eyes. I couldn't see it physically, but I kept it in my head. And because I kept a picture of the shoreline in my head, I was always at the shoreline. I was always at the shoreline because it never left my brain. And whenever I wanted to quit, I picked up the picture again and took a new look at the shoreline. Brothers and sisters, as you walk this Christian walk, it's going to get foggy. As you walk this Christian walk, it's going to get nighttime. And you're going to wonder, can I make it? What God is saying is that if you have pursued to know him, Jesus Christ will give you a picture of the shoreline. And if he gives you a picture of the shoreline, you can make it because you can see the shoreline even if you don't know where it's located. Because you can see him. That I might know him and the power of his resurrection. And all God's people said?
Yes.
Let's stand.